Welcome to the St. David's Summer Reading Project. I'm the Reverend Remington Sloan, the rector of St. David's Episcopal Church in Roswell, Georgia.
And I'm Rebecca Klein, St. David's Parish Administrator. The St. David's Summer Reading Project is designed to bring the St. David's community together as we read and discuss books recommended to us by three of our high school youth.
We'll be exploring three very different genres, but from a Christian perspective. We invite you to join in the conversation. Again, and welcome to the St. David's Summer Reading Project. This is Remington.
And this is Rebecca.
And hi there, I'm Luke.
We're so glad to be back with you as we conclude our reading of Frank Herbert's 1965 classic Dune.
Before we get started today, we'd like to warn you that we'll be talking about the conclusion of this book today. There will be spoilers. So if you haven't finished reading the book and you don't want the ending ruined, stop now. And finish the book. You've been warned.
As we conclude, there are so many conversations that we have left on the table. It's hard to try to cover 900 pages of a book in three podcast episodes. This one is going to be our bonus episode and will be shorter. But we want to make sure that we get a chance to come back and talk about some things that we may have skipped. As we were talking in the kind of pre-show dialogue, the best way for us to do this, perhaps, is to just have a moment to talk about our favorite parts of the ending. Rebecca, do you want to start us off there?
Yeah. So for a book that's so long, when the ending comes, it's fast and furious and it happens all at once. But there was two parts about the third book that I really, really, really loved. And one of them is the relationship of Hera to Paul and Paul's family, Jessica and his sister Aaliyah. Just a reminder, Hera was the wife, Jameis's wife, that Paul assumed responsibility for after he fought and defeated and killed Jameis. And it's a very interesting situation because, you know, he assumes responsibility for her and her two sons. And she ends up very, very, very loyal to Jessica in particular and Aaliyah. In fact, they refer to their relationship is she loves Aaliyah as if she were her own child. And one of my favorite characters in the book is Aaliyah, Paul's younger sister, who was born genetically modified by Jessica's experience with the Water of Life and is in some ways almost more prescient than Paul because has access to all the memories. But it also gives her some challenges in how she interacts with the Freeman. And how Hera is willing to negotiate because she's of Fremen and she kind of negotiates Aaliyah's relationship within the tribe, which I think is kind of really beautiful. And I think it's a relationship that really stands out to me. But then at the very end, where the shield walls have been broached and Aaliyah is sitting on the edge of the dais and she's kicking her feet like a 4-year-old would. Mm-hmm. And there's a line I just love, and it's called, you know, and her sandals winked out from beneath her robes. And it's just a great line. But then in the next second, like when the sandworms appear and she's like slitting throats, I mean, it's just like she's just a great character. She's unlike anything I've ever read before. Mm-hmm. And I really love her.
Yeah, she is. She's great. And that scene where she's kicking her feet, knowing that she's got the gom jabber tucked up underneath her robe or whatever and is ready to go is just classic and kind of iconic and wonderful. And I think you're right. I can't recall a character like that I've encountered in other sci-fi and fantasy books, or not one I've enjoyed as much as well. She is from the very beginning, she's kind of terrifying and people are calling her an abomination. And here she is, like she's, everybody else is playing checkers, and she's playing chess, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, she's just like this really unique character. She embodies this dichotomy between being a young, innocent child and being one of the most powerful and most prescient and most wise creatures mm-hmm. in the universe. Here she has the knowledge of every single reverend mother before her, so much that even the most powerful reverend mother, the emperor's truthsayer, Reverend Mother Mohiam, calls her an abomination, not because it's just out of disgust, but out of fear. Mm-hmm. Here's mm-hmm. someone who knows infinitely more than I do. She's going to have the power to change the way the universe works, and it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. at the same time, we have kicking of the feet, and here she is, just 4 years old. It's, I mean, remarkable.
Oh, she plays everybody. Mm-hmm. And you know what I love about it? Is she's so blatantly honest. It's, oh, I just love it, because she just speaks the truth, and she's calling it out, and, you know, she's almost not playing a game, but she is.
Right. I mean, we kind of talked about this in the first episode, this notion of kind of first half and second half of life mm-hmm. in the way that it doesn't mean that somebody has a chronological age divided into two different parts. She's living, well, I mean, she's living like a third way altogether, but she's certainly the infinite wisdom of countless generations of Bene Gesserit and all of that information tucked into this incredible brain still inhabiting a four-year-old body that can only be a four-year-old body. But she's not. She's certainly not conversing with people or playing the what she would probably call the charades of other political players or religious players or anything else. She is playing a universal game of chess.
She is the accident and the error, to refer to, back to Kynes. But also, one thing I love is that she's able to manipulate time and leave messages for Paul mm-hmm. and the Reverend Mothers. I mean, she's in their heads.
Right.
So she can, how cool is that?
It is so cool. Yeah.
It's cooler than a sandworm by far.
And that's really, I think that Paul has made this incredible leap as well. And I'll come back around to that in a moment, because that's one of my favorite scenes as we conclude the book. But as she and Paul are now, maybe not at the same level, but both at a much higher level than anybody else, their ability to navigate the time nexus, to leave messages, to be in the place that the Reverend Mother dare not look mm-hmm. and see that they are already standing there looking back out. I can't remember where that quote is. I think it's mm-hmm. in the throne room when the Emperor's going down. But these moments are really amazing, and Aaliyah and Paul are of a different type of being. The Reverend Mother in that moment, I think, says, like, welcome to humanity. I welcome you as a human, but you could probably read between the lines that she recognizes them as something beyond just human. Luke, what was your favorite part as we kind of came to the end of the book?
I was a big fan of, well, I don't know if fan is the right word, but Thufir Hawat and his, I guess, dying declaration of loyalty to Paul was really powerful. Hawat's been this very well-developed figure throughout the entire novel. He kind of goes everywhere and sees everything in the more physical sense rather than prescience. And, you know, we've talked about how he is a man of logic, but like all Mentats are, and yet he is able to feel emotion for his beloved Duke, Leto I, and as well as Paul. So when he comes back, he's been constantly poisoned, and he is on his deathbed, and he approaches Paul, and he has been told, you need to kill Paul, and he decides that he would rather die than kill Paul, mm-hmm. When he totally disregards all of the logic of putting yourself first for your own safety, your own well-being, in order to put his emotions before that, to spare the son of your beloved Duke. It's really this strong sense of loyalty. And Hawat and Gurney Halleck both have similar paths here of trying to find out how they can reunite with the Atreides family in a way that demonstrates their loyalty. they've all become good friends with the previous Duke, Duke Leto. They have strong connections there. I mean, Thufir Hawat has been a servant of the Atreides family for centuries. Mm-hmm. So when Hawat dies in this declaration of loyalty to Paul, and when Halleck returns from this, exile with the smugglers, mm-hmm. to join the Fremen, to join Paul at his side, it really shows how everything is now focusing on Paul. It's not about his father, the Duke, anymore. It highlights that Paul is now Duke of Arrakis. Mm-hmm. And you see, as Paul negotiates, along with Stilgar, a leadership settlement mm-hmm. with the Fremen, so they don't need to kill Stilgar and they don't need to ignore Paul. They negotiate the Usul versus Duke arrangement. It shows Paul is kind of just taking the role of leader in all of these situations. He's going from the first book, where he's being guided by the decisions of his mother Jessica, his father Duke Leto, his teachers Duncan Idaho, Gurney Halleck, and Thufir Hawat.
And Stilgar.
Bene Gesserit, Stilgar. I mean, book one is all about him being kind of pushed around by people. Book two, he finds himself in an unfamiliar situation in the desert with the Fremen, being chased by sandworms and Sardaukar, and he's in these unfamiliar situations and he's being pushed about around, but he has some resistance. He's like trying to find his footing. And then in book three, we finally have that realization that he is in control. He is the Duke of Arrakis. He is the Kwisatz Haderach. He is the Messiah. So the death of Thufir Hawat and this declaration of loyalty kind of encapsulates how everything has shifted to focus around him mm-hmm. rather than anybody else or anything else.
It's a really touching scene, and given the journey that Thufir has been on, one might wonder all the emotion that could be on those pages that's not necessarily represented, but that loyalty that's present with his last breath is so beautiful. I think still Thufir is projecting onto Paul the role of Duke, and Gurney would be the same, and these other characters, take Stilgar, is seeing Usul or Ma'adib. I think Paul and Aaliyah may be the only two who can really understand what's actually happening as Paul rises. I like that Aaliyah is there because it probably shields Paul from some sense of deep isolation, but otherwise it seems like there's huge disconnect between who he was and who he is becoming, and these bridges that are connecting or providing continuity are dying or are otherwise diminishing. And it's abrupt, it seems, at the end. Did you take it as abrupt toward the end there as these things happen?
It did feel very like as though the universe was kind of just cutting him off mm. from whatever he was before. Because I do think, like, Paul, as well as everyone around him, realizes, like, whoever Paul was, this Duke apparent, this heir, living, I mean, even going all the way back to Caladan, living in paradise on this ocean planet, like, that's just not who he was anymore. This mm-hmm. boy who still struggled to use the voice, who was still in fear of the Bene Gesserit, being controlled by his mother and his father, like, not him anymore.
Right.
He's like this totally new person in all internal looking back on that. Any of the leftovers from that previous life, they're gone. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's from that life, save for Jessica, their stories are coming to an end. And I think Paul realizes that, and that's probably why he has this, resolve to move forward and take his place in the Imperial family, in this Messiah figure, to, follow his destiny rather than resort back to what was the past.
It strikes me, as I'm looking at you, Luke, who is in high school and living in the same age range that Paul starts this journey and then it concludes, that I've never thought of this as a coming-of-age story, but as you reflect on it in that way, the disconnect between his story of origin and this rapid change in his life, not concluded, but this book, this sort of chapter of his life is concluded by a massive transition into a new sense of being that's high school written into a cosmological battle between forces of good and evil and so on and so forth. When you read the book, did you relate to Paul as a teenage character as well?
I mean, I definitely drew some parallels. He was very cozy, to say, living in Caladan, being taught and served by all of these people. And then he kind of is forced to grow up when his entire family and way of life has moved to Arrakis. I mean, one could say that's a transition from middle to high school or whatever that is. And then he finds that he's got fewer and fewer friends there as relationships change on Arrakis, because Arrakis changes people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a physical, oh, now there's sand. It's kind of this psychological, well, everything mm-hmm. has to change. Mm-hmm. So I definitely drew some parallels there. The way some relationships change, whether it is a complete ending, like we see with the deaths of some major characters, whether it is just a shift in roles, like seeing the introduction of Stilgar as a friend rather than a competing leader,
mm-hmm.
or even just tension he has with his own family. The tension with Jessica, the sudden addition of a new sister that he comes to realize is going to happen before even Jessica knows. He just knows, oh, I'm not going to be the only child anymore. All of these different changes, all of this universal stuff could really just be reduced down to some YA coming-of-age novel.
Well, and it's also really interesting that one of the moments that I feel is so pivotal for Paul is right before the battle when he starts stepping into the Duke of Arrakis role, and he sees Stilgar accept him as the, I can never say it, kid's witch, Haderach?
Haderach.
Okay. But he says, and I saw the man diminish in front of me. So when he accepts the role of a follower, he loses somewhat of that friendship and the diminishment of, but that's also part of coming of an age for him, because he's stepping into the leadership role. And I think he'll always highly regard Stilgar, and I think he'll always respect him, but he realizes that he's no longer an equal, which is kind of bittersweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because they do have all these conversations about what their roles are. When they sit around trying to figure out how to avoid some kind of duel between them, when they try to figure out what's the best way to move forward, we both know we like each other, we're friends, but how can we progress in a way that is beneficial to the Fremen, our people,
mm-hmm.
but also to our own relationship. So I guess this final decision of this is where we stand. You're going to take on this position as Duke of Arrakis, which they both know it's not only the Duke of Arrakis.
Yeah.
It's this bigger, more significant meeting. The Duke of Arrakis is now tied to the Imperial family. It's tied to the coming Jihad.
And the Harkonnens, because they reveal that he is the grandson of the Baron. But that does come out. So in a way, he's like, we're going to endure the pain and ensnare the hunter. And he did it. I mean, he has suffered. I mean, he lost his father. He lost his child. And yet he has endured the pain and entrapped the hunter.
Truly, I mean, his narrative arc there is extraordinary. I feel like it was rushed at the end. Mm. I wish we could have stayed in that space a little bit more, that there were more callbacks and a little bit more drama there. To me, it seems like a really rapid movement from the scene, again, that I kind of want to come back to with the Water of Life and his realization that, oh, we could also do the Water of Death. And the next thing you know, the storm is taking down the shield, and they're blowing up the shield wall with atomic weapons, the family atomics, and riding sandworms into this. What just happened? And then the next thing you know, it's just kind of over. But that's the moment. All this that he's endured, 700 pages of largely suffering, and what's come out on the other side is this incredible being. But that's also part of the thematic work, I think, that if Arrakis is like another Seleucus Secundus, look how this harsh environment has produced this incredible human being. It's a terrible theme in its own way, and yet it's repeated in such a way that we have to see it as something of a reality, at least on these pages.
As Christians, too, if you want to look at this from a Christian perspective, you know, suffering is awful and we never want it to happen, but is it something that we have to endure, experience, to reach a higher level of faith? I mean, I want to be very careful how I'm saying this. I don't want to say suffering is good and should be, you know, glorified in any way, but is it?
There's a concept called redemptive suffering, the notion that in order for us to move to a place of redemption, we move through suffering. That suffering is just a reality, and this is common to multiple religions, but suffering is part and parcel to being a human being living in this universe until there is a new universe, let's say, until we access the realm of the divine. But suffering is part of the path that leads to redemption. And in Christianity, of course, that is most visible in the person of Jesus. If he could have saved us without suffering, one might imagine that he would have. But that's not the way that the world works. The world is, again, in this reality, built to create suffering more than it is to alleviate it. But as Christians, I think we're supposed to find ways to help alleviate it. But it also calls to mind for me one of the readings from last Sunday. Since we are justified by faith, this is Paul writing to the Romans, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have obtained access to this grace in which we stand. We boast in our hope of sharing in the glory of God. And not only that, but we also boast in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. I've always appreciated that. Not all suffering is intended to be there for us, but it also doesn't have to destroy us. It can be the fertile soil in which hope is cultivated and brought into existence. And certainly in my experience, that has been true, that every place that I have gone where suffering is a more present reality than it is in most of the suburban affluent context that I've done ministry, on, let's say, a mission trip, I'll often see these people know more about endurance and know more about hope and know more about what it is to be faithful than I will know in the course of my lifetime, even with the guarantee that I will also meet suffering in my lifetime. There is something about that environment that produces a higher degree of faith and hope and a different manifestation of love. And if those are Christian things, there's something in there that should be a signal to us that we should go to places, spiritually and physically, we should go to places on the margins, and we should go to places where we can find that suffering so that we can also experience the depths and truth of faith and hope and love.
I really like how it's also from Paul. I like the I like the little tie-in. It's, that couldn't be more perfect if we tried.
Yeah. It may be that Frank Herbert did that intentionally. I'm not really sure. Certainly, he had a lot of exposure to the Roman Catholic Church as a kid. So speaking of Paul, I want to come back to the scene with the water of life, and I won't dwell on it too much, but for me that is the most important scene in his character development, and for me, as one reading it, really focused on the theme of the Messiah's rise to power. It's the one that that draws the most attention for me. So here's Paul, and he has gone into a 3-week coma. Everybody believes him to be dead or near death, and he is returning to life all of a sudden. And he's there with Chani and with his mother. And one part of the scene that I think is so impressive is that Jessica and Chani and Paul have this conversation in which all of them can recognize that Paul really has been elevated to this higher station of existence, that he sees not only the future and knows the past, but he's also capable of seeing the present moment, and not just the present moment in the room, but all of the beings around them for thousands of miles, including straight up into space where the Emperor and the Spacing Guild and all the major houses have come to visit. He has incredible awareness of the present moment and really has been elevated. In that moment, one of the Fedekin, the sort of Imperial Guard, has been listening and paying attention, and you know all of a sudden, like, the jihad has started.
Mm-hmm.
Here is a character who's just watched the person he already believed to be the Messiah die and now come back to life, and in coming back to life has some new supernatural ability, and he's off to tell the masses. He is the Mary Magdalene running away from the tomb, and I just love it. I think that that's an amazing parallel. Then within that, I see Paul taking a different branch, and there is contrast. We talked about character development early. One of Rebecca's favorite ways of reading is to read about the characters in such a way that either by seeing parallel or by seeing contrast, we can understand more about what we value. Paul takes the route of violence. Jesus takes the route of nonviolence. And I'm drawn to nonviolence, though the story would have gotten really boring had Paul been a nonviolent Messiah. I wonder what that might have looked like. Aaliyah would have taken care of it anyway, I'm sure. But here is a major divergent movement from the messianic expectation that a Christian might bring into the story. But I think that's important. I think that Jesus is offered that same kind of rise to power. That's the temptation narrative in the wilderness, that he could have all the kingdoms of the universe, and he could have all the power, and he could be able to have supernatural feats of ability or protection or whatever other manifestation of messianic hope might allow him to become the one who leads the way to a manifestation of that power such that all the other power structures in the universe will bow to him. And he rejects all of it. Paul wants to reject it. He seems to be unable to at some level. But I love how Herbert's playing with that. And I love being able to read that as somebody who values and is drawn into the Christian narrative around the Messiah. I think it's great.
Well, isn't this also what the early Christians, after the death of Jesus, expected when his resurrection? They expected him to come back immediately and kind of fix the wrongs.
He did, yeah.
And
come
so,
back with the angel army and
yeah,
destroy.
And yeah. Yet Paul is kind of I wonder if Frank Herbert was playing with that idea of what if Jesus had come back right away and become the angel army?
Yeah, sure. I think he is. And I think we talked about this again a little bit in the pre-show conversation, how as Jesus comes back and ushers in a radical community of peace and love, which is not exactly what Paul is doing, that works for a little while until, all of a sudden, Christianity becomes the imperial religion and exercises dominance and exploitation and power as a way to control and destroy their enemies so that they can have global unity, at least nominal unity. That, I think, he's just kind of jumping the gun with what is facing Paul. That Paul comes back, skips the period of peace, or maybe that's what we're about to enter into with the destruction of the Imperial force and the threatening of the destruction of the Spice and the Spacing Guild by extension. But Paul is going to rise, or at least it looks like at the end of this book, he's going to rise into a place of just replacing the emperor with a more powerful emperor. And unity, yes, but unity with a high price to pay in human blood.
And I do think that could be paralleled to Christianity's unity with the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. How Christianity was kind of this minor persecuted religion until it became adopted as the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Right.
And to go through all of that, there was a lot of bloodshed. The Romans liked persecuting people. It was Jews and it was Christians, and then Christianity merges with the Roman Empire, and that's where we get the imperialism that Christianity was associated with. And that kind of merger, it could be tied to Paul and this notion of trying to find a better place for humanity, because that's what the entire idea of being the Messiah is about. How can we get humanity to a place where they are better, where they are evolved, and everyone can live peacefully? And he really, really tries to find a peaceful way there. He looks into every possible future, trying to see, how can we get to this place? How can I shorten the path, as the name Quisas Hadarach implies? How can I shorten the path to get to this high point in humanity with as minimal life-taking as possible? And he realizes, like, there is no way to spread the word without associating himself with this jihad. And it's similar, like, without the imperialism that Christianity was tied to during the first few centuries, it was associated with the Roman Empire and then the Crusades and the Roman Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire, all of that. Without Christianity and Catholicism being tied there, you have to wonder, like, would Christianity spread to all of these different places?
Oh, right.
It only found its way to the west coast and south of Africa by way of colonizers and enslavers. Now, one could say it might have found its way going from Ethiopia down throughout the rest of the continent. Mm-hmm. But then you have to wonder, like, what about South America? What about the other Americas? Like, that was all because of colonization. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, like, can just a religion based around pure love, nothing imperialistic, nothing warmongering, can that spread? Or do these other malevolent forces, colonization and imperialism and war, are those going to counteract any religion that preaches love for one's neighbor, even if you don't know them, love for one's enemy? And, you know, Paul tries to find that balance. He's like, how can I get humanity to this place? How can I follow through on my destiny without harming people? And he comes to the conclusion that's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you wonder, well, what does that say about our humanity here in the year 2022? We're not even 8,000-10,000 years ahead, and yet we're drawn to answer the question of, if we are faced with the option of spreading Christianity through love only, going and being evangelicals from a point of love, will that be a way to spread Christianity, spread the word of God? Or do we have to be like our ancestors were, joining empires and conquests and colonizing and doing whatever it takes?
Right.
Yeah.
It's an experiment we haven't run in 1700 years. I'm kind of eager to see what it's going to look like from the moment that Constantine legalizes Christianity and later Theodosius adopts it as the official imperial religion. The message of Jesus and the practice of disciples has been influenced or completely dominated by colonizing and imperial mentality. And it's so hard to extract anything we know about Christian religion and practice from the 1700 years. You just, again, thinking about it in terms of a ratio, 300 years of Christianity as Jesus probably hoped that we would practice it with some varying degrees of success, and then 1700 years of us practicing religion as the empire would shape it. We really don't know how to do the first thing very well. And I say we, pointing specifically to the Episcopal Church, because though we talk a good game about love, we were part of one of the largest empires that the world has ever seen. Colonizing was in our DNA when we came to these colonies. And though we took on a different manifestation The Episcopal Church, immediately following the American Revolution, was the church of power and influence, because so many senators and so many presidents and so many people at the center of power were Episcopalians. And we lived from that place. And so we really don't know how to do Christianity on the margins. We don't know how to do Christianity free of the trappings of colonizing and imperial mentality. But we're going to find out.
Yeah. Well, that's the way we're heading.
That's where we're headed. Yeah.
We got to develop our own Arrakis and become tougher.
Well, yeah, that if secularism is the tough environment in which we'll have to learn how to practice Christianity born completely out of the influence of love rather than the exercise of power, the good news is we're headed there. And I really do see it as good news, for what it's worth. It's a strange thing for a priest who's rooted in an institution to say that, but I think we will get closer to the heart of Jesus as we are forced out of the sphere of power that we've existed in for the last 240 years. So,
well,
there's a part of me that looks forward to it.
Without power, when your faith is tested, does it become more pure?
If purity is measured by the one who became powerless on our behalf, then I would say so, yes.
Interesting.
I mean, yeah, we talked about how suffering, I mean, this is obviously not suffering, but being faced with challenges historically and biblically leads to greater faith. From all the way back, we go to Abraham. He and his wife, childless, he knows that if he doesn't have the help of God, his bloodline will end. He's faced with these challenges. He's suffering because back then your bloodline was like, that was the root of your existence to continue the legacy. And he has children with his concubines, and then God gifts him with his son, with Sarah. And then you go to Jacob, who would become Israel, wrestling with an angel. He has this fight, this moment of fear. Here he is wrestling with a guy, and he's wondering what will happen if this. And then he understands by divine revelation, he is going to be one of the patriarchs of a great nation. You have all of these different figures that are faced with challenges, as big as being beaten and hung upon a cross, to even just minor, like being outcast because you're a tax collector. Mm-hmm. All of these people go through problems and struggles in their lives, and they come out better. They come out more faithful, and whether it be the actual physical intervention of Jesus coming to heal the sick and the blind and the leper, or just pure faith. Paul wandering around and then realizing what he has to become, or even modern day people who wonder what life is like, and then they come to terms with what their own faith is, and they become stronger, they become better people mm-hmm. because of their own internal faith being greeted by this God, by faith, by Jesus. After being confronted with struggles, with suffering, it really does like make faith stronger after being confronted with all of these problems.
In the early church, that's one of the things that I think was so impressive to so many, is that when they would come into Christian community, they would see, well, these folks have the same struggles as I have, and yet look how they love one another. Mm. Look how they cultivate hope. Look how they practice faith in the midst of a difficult world. And they seem to embrace that they will love each other through it, and that that is a better option than cozying up to the empire that would promise sedative for reality. And those promises are always going to be empty promises. The people who can see through that move toward the community of faith and hope and love anyway.
And I think Bonhoeffer is actually a really great modern example of that, because, you know, so Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran minister in Nazi Germany who was imprisoned because he was preaching the gospel of love. and became an enemy of the Nazi regime and was imprisoned. And in prison, they actually had a, there were several other faith leaders, and they formed this community of faith, and he wrote several books about it, and he was actually executed and has become one of a modern day saint, if you will, or martyr. He's in the National Cathedral. They have a statue to him, and it's a really interesting story. But in while he was imprisoned, his faith deepened so much. And I mean, they were bare bones being able to practice faith. And he kind of stands as a modern day example of faith and suffering and hope.
As we wrap up our time today, I thought we would end with the end. As Paul is encountering the emperor and his truth-sayer and discussing the future, there is a beautiful scene in which Paul lays out his hope for the future of Arrakis, a green oasis rich with good things, but always with a desert that can produce spice as well. And then the truth-sayer, Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, has her vision of a future, and she can see the jihad that is coming. And she stops for a moment and says, "You cannot loose these people, the Fremen, upon the universe." There is, of course, more to this story. If you have read all 700 pages of the narrative and maybe the other additional couple hundred pages of the appendices, congratulations, good for you, and yet you probably know, like we do, that the story is not over yet.
Following the events in Book 1, Dune, Paul continues his story along with all of the other characters we have met in this book and all of the other characters we have yet to meet. The next book in the Dune series written by Frank Herbert is Dune Messiah, where we follow Paul and his family and all of his allies, friends, and enemies as we continue on Arrakis, the desert planet. So make sure, if you enjoyed this book, that you read Dune Messiah.
So, Luke, I have a question for you as we reach the conclusion of Dune. What did you take away from reading Dune and the podcast experience?
I thought it was definitely an enlightening experience. We have talked a whole lot about Dune as a novel beyond just sci-fi, as a coming-of-age novel, as a commentary on Christianity, the Catholic Church, the Crusades, all of it, and this big metaphor for everything that happens with religion, with politics, with society, with messiahs, and all of this. And I really think that it's been rather interesting to talk about the religious and Christian aspects of Dune with a church administrator and a priest. I can't really, like, on my own read this book and provide the same insight that an ordained minister would have, because I didn't go through seminary. I don't know my theology to the extent that Remington has. So being able to sit down and talk about the book and get your insights, because as a younger person, I don't have the insights into some of these more adult themes, grown-up themes as it is, all of these big picture things that I just can't relate to as of yet. Last episode, we talked about the, I guess, feminist influences on Jessica. And as a man, I'm not able to relate to those, but you, Rebecca, were, because you are a woman and you're able to look at Jessica's character and add your own insight. So I just think it's been a really cool experience to see what y'all have to add, bouncing off ideas and commentary, and really exploring what Dune is. It's more than just a fun read. It's this really deep book that makes you think and wonder not only about yourself and not only about the universe and all of the aspects that play in, but how you relate to those. Where do you stand? What is your destiny in this big, confusing universe? We may not have an Padishah Emperor or big houses, but finding out where we relate in this big, crazy universe with all these factors in play, all these organizations trying to get this and that. It's been really interesting to hear from y'all about how this novel, how its themes really play together to create this question of who are we as humans and as individuals.
I want to pause there long enough to say that don't downplay your access to insight on any number of important themes, but also the theology. One of the things that I can reflect back to you on behalf of some members in this parish is their being impressed with who you are and your insight, but also your ability to see and understand the nuances of many different political and religious factors that play in this narrative, as well as within the world around us. They picked up on that because you bring it to the table, and so thank you for it. One of our big hopes would be that we could find a way to have an intergenerational book club and let the youth of this church lead us. And so far, this has gone very well, knowing that there are people ranging from 15 to 85 reading Dune alongside us and drawing from one another resources and insight and inspiration for reading and learning and growing.
I would like to add, when you read a book and you're reading it by yourself, you are walking a very singular path. And there is something so valuable when you discuss a book with other people and they challenge your ideas and your assumptions, and you get the opportunity to listen deeply and discuss, because there were several things here discussed in this podcast that I didn't pick up on. But even the second time reading it, but through the conversation, led to additional questions that I had never even thought of. So I thank both of you, and Luke, especially you, bringing your insights. I think this has been a whole lot of fun and a whole lot of education.
Amen and amen. And the world needs a whole lot more conversation in which we listen to one another and draw insights from one another, and not less. And so that's one more way that St. David's can shine a light, is by intentionally entering into these types of conversations. As we wrap up today, we want to make sure that we invite you, the listener, to join us next week. We start a new book, the 2006 work by Daniel Levitin, This Is Your Brain on Music. Levitin is a cognitive psychologist, if I recall correctly, and also was a producer and sound designer back in the day as well, and so brings all of that to bear as he takes us in a journey of the way in which music interacts with the human mind. We'll be joined by Julia Daniels next week as we enter into our first section on the book.
And until next time, go forth into the world to love and to read.